All right, Kate. Kate, where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
Originally, I'm from Bakersfield, California. Not too far from here.
Tell me about your family growing up.
I have an older brother, 2 years older, and my parents were together the majority of my childhood. I'd say that I always thought that I had a pretty relatively normal childhood. Like we traveled and were middle class and stuff. But I always had trouble making friends in school. I just kind of recently found out that I have autism, so that's been kind of reevaluating the way I've looked and kind of analyzed my past and my story, which is kind of why I kept postponing this, because I wanted that to be an element to the story too. But yeah, so I had a really hard time making friends in school, but I always had at least like one best friend or so. And I hung out with my brother a lot, because I was very much a tomboy, still am. Like to just play outside and do whatever my brother was doing. And I tried like every sport you can imagine, was just very like adventurous, I guess, trying new things. And I finally found the sport that I fell in love with, which was cheer. I was in fourth grade. And even though I fell in love with cheer, I wouldn't say cheer necessarily loved me, but it was for a pretty well-known company in Bakersfield. Not for a school. I've never cheered for a school before. So it was a club competing team. And I eventually got on the traveling competitive team and worked with these infamous two female coaches, Miss Dunn and Miss Shelley. And I mean, they were known for producing champions. We were definitely a hard team to beat, definitely statewide, but even one of the top teams in nationals. And it's like the dance moms kind of scenario where the coaches are pretty brutal and they're pretty mean and they're pretty demanding. And I just wanted to please everyone. I was always like a straight A student on a roll, so I worked really, really hard for that company. And I mean, like 6, 7 days a week, multiple trainings a day. It kind of became my life. And even though like I really wanted to be friends with everyone on the team, it was again hard for me to make friends. I was always put in the back. And again, even though like I'm a tomboy, I liked cheer, not definitely not for like I hated like the beauty part of it, but that was, only when we competed. Other than that, it was just a lot of like acrobatics and athleticism, and I loved tumbling and doing tricks and stuff. And I started puberty pretty young, actually, like around that time too, around fourth or fifth grade. And I just got really like big and tall and just awkward in my body. And like I got like my period for the first time in sixth grade, and it was like one of the worst case scenarios in the middle of school with khaki pants on. And I literally thought I was dying. I had no idea what was happening. And I didn't know what was happening because, like, although like my family was like pretty normal or whatever, we just weren't like affectionate, and we didn't talk about, like serious stuff or things that would be considered taboo, at least in the 90s, early 90s. And so my mom didn't talk to me about puberty, and we didn't talk about the period. Like I like hid everything in my closet until she eventually found it, and I think I had like a pamphlet waiting for me. So it was just it's just like a weird dynamic when like families keep secrets. And I listen to the show a lot because it's helped me identify a lot with my own story and understand my own story. But I think we've seen that one of the biggest themes is generational trauma. And my family story is no different. My mom's mom, my grandma, she was at a party when she was young, like 16, and got drunk and, you know, passed out. And then a couple weeks later was sick and found out she was pregnant with my mom. And, you know, to this day, we still, I don't think we have any clue who that man was. But my mom was born in the early 60s. And my grandma was the daughter of a pastor in Texas. And so this was very not okay, to say the least. And so they made the decision to raise my mom as if her and my grandma were sisters. And so she thought that, you know, her grandparents were her parents her whole life. And at some point, my mom found out, and somewhere between, I think, the ages of like 10 and 14, and it went really badly. It was a disastrous day, so I've heard. And I know my mom was already kind of fucked up from things happening to her when she was, you know, a child from family members being inappropriate with her. And all of that resentment that she had towards my grandma for what I don't think was honestly like her fault. It wasn't her fault. It was, she did the best she could. She was in a very different situation and world than we're in today. And my mom's resentment made it to where she kept my grandma's identity from me and my brother until about sixth grade. So whenever we would, none of our family lives in California. We would always go to Texas and Oklahoma to visit both sides of family. And we would always visit this couple, and John and Barbara was all I knew about them. And I liked them a lot, especially because I'm such a black sheep in my family and I don't connect. I don't feel like I'm really related to a lot of people in my family sometimes. But I really liked her a lot. And turns out that she was my grandma. So that was a lot to take in, but I just kind of found it ironic that, you know, there was this secret kept from my mom and that fucked her up. And then my mom decided to keep a secret from me as well. And I only found out the actual story of what happened and how my mom came to be from overhearing it in the backseat of a car one time. So I guess that's when things started changing a little bit. My family moved into a new house and a new development. And I went to a new school, started middle school, and I didn't really know anyone there because we had moved. And I had made a couple friends that were new. Like one of, like a parent's worst nightmare kind of a friend. I had this one girl who was, I thought, so cool and so adult for, you know, being in seventh grade. She had a very young, hip mom, and they drank and they had a boat and did cool stuff. And because that's like part of the autistic thing is, kind of following and mimicking whatever your friends do and stuff. I just did whatever she did. And because of her, I started you know, I had my first cigarette, and she taught me how to sneak out of my house. And we started hanging out with some neighborhood kids, including this group of brothers. And I started drinking a little bit too. And then one of the brothers, so I was a year younger than everyone in my grade, because I started school a year early. And there was a guy who was in our grade, and then he had an older brother. I don't know, he was like a few years older than me, that we would always hang out with. And he started like coming over to my house in the middle of the night and had me like come outside. And again, like, I didn't know anything about sex. I didn't know anything about literally anything. Like, I hadn't learned that yet in school, and my school wasn't teaching much. And he would just like do whatever he kind of wanted, with me. And I didn't really understand it. And I never wanted it, that's for sure, because I definitely was not attracted to him. I thought he was very kind of gross, very like greasy, and like he, you know, was really into insane clown posse and stuff, and would play this intense music that I had no idea what they were talking about. I can't imagine listening to it nowadays. It'd probably be just like horrifying. But he was intimidating as hell. And he had these like really intense, like terrifyingly beautiful eyes. And so that was something that would happen every now and then, throughout like my seventh grade year. And then around fall of 2001, so going into eighth grade, one of my close friends that was also friends with that girl, she lived in the neighborhood, Allison. We were really close, and we would also like sneak out, and I think her parents were like alcoholics. We used to drink a lot of, you know, her parents' alcohol. They had a ton in the house. And she was over at my house staying the night one time, and it wasn't like every single time we hung out we would go out and do things, and especially not her. She wasn't like a really bad influence, honestly. She was definitely like more of a better, well-rounded kid. But we were gonna go to bed, and that guy David came over and knocked on my window, because my room was, you know, front facing of the house, and which made it easy to sneak in and out of my window. And he came in my room, and I just remember, just we didn't want him there. We just had wanted to just go to bed. And he like sat on my bed, and, you know, just like eventually just like pulled out his dick and was like touching it and stuff, and like telling us that he wanted us to do things. And I didn't even like understand the lingo or the terminology. And I just remember this was like the first time I had seen a dick other than, you know, like when I was a child having a bath, you know, with like my brother or something. And so it was like, I just remember being like just so grossed out by it and just mortified. And like, I remember like smelling, like the smell was horrible. And he like wanted us to, you know, now I know, give him head and stuff. And It was awful. I bit him, in which, like, he didn't like, but also I think he kind of did like it because I think he always liked the game aspect of what he could do or get away with. And honestly, like, I would get asked later on, like, why I didn't say anything? Why didn't I, like, call for, like, my parents or something? And honestly, my dad was scarier than this guy. The thought of my dad coming in and just seeing that he was there and what would happen was much scarier than what was happening there. I could just disassociate. So my dad's very, he's worked a lot on his anger issues now, but he had really bad anger issues my whole life. And he was always really intense and really strict. And his methods of punishment aren't exactly any forms of punishment I would ever do to my kids. But so I just remember afterwards walking her back to her house and just talking about how our necks were sore because, you know, you're like resisting and getting pushed and just like felt fucked up and didn't really understand what happened. In a lot of ways, I still am learning and processing what happened. But we didn't talk about it and just kind of went about our normal lives. And then a few months later, he was bragging about it to a neighborhood kid who was pretty young. And the kid, being freaked out by what he was hearing, he told his like sister, who told her like parent, who told my friend's mom, who told my mom. And then next thing you know, the cops are being called and we're being interviewed about it. And I just remember just being so scared because I thought like I was going to be in trouble. And I think I still am struggling with feeling at fault and at blame for it. But I just remember feeling so much shame and so much guilt. And it was just like one of the worst nights ever. Like I couldn't look at my parents and my parents were so like it was horrible. And we never spoke about it again. The sex crime investigator, you know, told my parents that I was going to need therapy and that never happened. And even years later, when I had brought it up again, it never happened because they were, again, not wanting to talk about this stuff and just brush it on the under the rug and pretend like it didn't happen. And so he was arrested, went to court, ended up going to like some kind of juvie camp or something. And I don't know why, but I don't know if because it was my house or because I wasn't exactly well-liked in my group of friends that I was kind of a part of, but I got really blamed for what happened and everyone sided with him and I lost like all of my friends and gained a lot of guy friends. Of course. But that time was also really rough because also starting around that, around middle school was when I started having my own back problems and issues. I was also on a competitive tumbling team too, and just a lot of high impact tumbling was starting to weigh on me, and I was losing my flexibility and I was getting like feeling a lot of pain when I would tumble and my coaches were just like screaming in my ear, you know, for like not stretching deep enough and not, I don't know, working hard enough. And I went to like a chiropractor for like a year before I finally saw an orthopedic surgeon, got an MRI, went down to Anaheim and competed We won and had to stay for another day so we could film it for ESPN. And I came back, got my results back, and like I had such a bad herniated disc that my vertebrae were touching. And my doctor just looked at me like, how are you even sitting here? Like, how did you compete? And my condition just went really downhill after that. I was bedridden for a little over a month. This is now like early 2002, so eighth grade, right before the whole cop thing happened. I had my first back surgery, and I was out of school for a few months because I was bedridden before and bedridden after. And I eventually went back to school, but no one even noticed that I was gone. And that ended my cheer career. And that was like the one thing that I really, really loved and was passionate about. So it was a rough time. By high school, you know, just started continuing drinking more and smoking more and smoking more weed now. And me and that girl kind of drifted apart after a while. We got stalked by that guy for years. Like he would always somehow find out whenever we were staying together and bang on our windows. And we know it was him because it doesn't make sense for it to be anyone else. And I was like really into wanting to be a crime scene investigator at the time. So I was like, we would like have our notebooks and we would jot down every time it would happen and we would try to like collect evidence. But one night I was coming home with my family and he was outside of my window and I was like, okay, I knew it was him. And he came and bothered me all the time throughout high school, at least like the first half of high school. And I got bullied a lot for it throughout high school, even after high school. But I got a new group of friends and started hanging out with this girl, Megan. And we spent a lot of time hanging out with this big group of people who would have like off-road vehicles. And we would go into the hills out in Bakersfield and, you know, have these like keggers in the fields and just go off-roading and run from the cops and stuff. And it was like super fun and just like a wild time. And we got really good. We started practicing like lying to our parents to, you know, stay out overnight doing whatever we wanted. And so one night we had told our parents we were doing something, and whatever our plans were, it fell through pretty quickly, and we realized like we couldn't go home and we didn't know where we could go. So we hit up this guy that we knew from those field parties and knew that he had his own apartment. And so I'm like 16 at this time. And we go to his house and I don't think we had been drinking that night. I know I was definitely sober at that point. But, you know, we were drinkers and he asked us if we wanted a drink and we were like, sure. And, you know, he goes into his kitchen and makes one and brings it out and I have a couple sips. And from there, I have like two distinctive memories. One of them, I realized like I was on the ground, like in the living room, and I just remember like looking over and seeing my friend, and she doesn't have like her top on or anything. And like, we weren't like that. Like her and I were not like those kinds of girls, and we weren't that. And I was dating somebody at the time too, that I really liked. And I was not that type of person either. And, yeah, it just sucked. Like it was a really quick flash of just kind of looking over and remembering her. And then I knew that in his room, he had a loft bed And I remember like sitting up and hitting my head on the ceiling and seeing that I was naked and was like, why am I naked? And extremely uncomfortable that I was naked. And I don't remember anything else after that. And then woke up and went home. It was, if anyone has ever been roofied, they know that the hangover is pretty brutal for that. And I just went to the guy's house that I was dating, and I was so confused, and I didn't understand what happened, and I was trying to understand what happened, and I just like was like texting him, and he wasn't responding, and I kept calling him, and sometimes he would answer, and then he wouldn't respond, and then he would just hang up, and I just kept calling back, and was like, "What happened? Like, I don't understand. I don't know what happened." And and again, like, I totally took the blame and thought it was like my fault and like what I got for putting myself in that situation. And I didn't, and I don't know, I didn't, I didn't get validation until a few years later. It's a story that I'm not going to get into, but I ended up, he had a girlfriend at that time. And I ended up being roommates with her in college, which was a weird story. I went to Cal State Channel Islands, and he had admitted it, what he had done. And it was validating, but also just, I don't know, infuriating at the same time. So, yeah, any, like, relationship I had with men was pretty fucked up pretty much from the start. Like, I had lost my virginity when I was 15 to one of the guys I met at one of those field parties. And all I remember about him was that he was a firefighter and well past the legal drinking age. And again, I was 15, so it took me so many years to learn and understand that that guy was probably pretty fucked up, and that was not a good situation. Like, it was like something I almost thought was like cool for a long time, that older men had always liked me, had always liked me since I was a small child. I don't know, but I by this point I'm not really a good student anymore. Again, I was like an honor roll straight A student my whole life, and then high school, I just started really slipping in my grades, started ditching a lot, just smoking cigarettes every day, and like I started stealing and stuff. And I found out that my parents were like fighting and going through their own issues. And like my senior year of high school, I just remember like one of my biggest goals was I want to do cocaine. And I probably got that idea from a movie or a show. But I just remember being hell-bent on the fact that I wanted to try cocaine. And after I graduated high school, I got my wish, and it was love at first sniff. And I got just dove straight into it. Not too long after that, I had gotten a little, overdose too. And after that happened, my friends came over, they had called my mom, and they had this intervention for me and stuff. So it got out of hand like pretty quickly. And I was also like very much addicted to opiates at this point. So this is, you know, the early 2000s and the height of the opiate, the start of the OxyContin epidemic. And I got on all of that, of course, because of my back surgery, and still had, you know, back issues and back pain for years after. But I somehow made it into college, probably only because it was a brand new school at the time, and so they were kind of letting anyone in, I think. But I went to Cal State Chana Islands, and my parents had split at that point, and my mom had just retired, so she actually moved to the town where it's at, Camarillo, so she could be nearby in case I had like another overdose, which ended up being really useful because I sure enough did have other overdoses. And I started working for this, if anyone even remembers the clothing brand, No Fear. They had a store in Simi Valley, and I started working there right when I started college. And my first day, I'm out with my assistant manager, and we're in like a drive-through line of Taco Bell, and somehow cocaine gets brought up, and turns out her and her boyfriend are huge cocaine, you know, fans. And I just got really, really into it again. And ended up eventually dropping out of college after like a year and a half. Had a lot more back pain too, and got diagnosed with degenerative disc disease. So essentially the disc that they did surgery on failed, and I started having herniated discs going up my spine. And so I got a new surgeon and a new plan for surgery, but I was holding off on it because it was pretty invasive. But I got into a pretty bad car accident that totaled my car and kind of forced me to get my back surgery. And so I had my second one in 2008, and they did a total disc replacement. So I had another surgeon that just was there to open me up and take out my organs and keep me alive so they can take everything out and replace it. And that was a pretty like extensive surgery. I was out for a while and had to use a walker for a long time. I had also like upped my opiate game to morphine at that point. I was on a ton of morphine for like years, and I had a like a pain management doctor. I had to go through detox eventually to get off of the morphine because I was on a lot of it. But yeah, from my car accident, I got a nice settlement. And with that settlement, I went to makeup school, and I went to cosmetology school. And around that time was when I really, really started developing my eating disorder. And it got really bad to the point where, like a month shy from graduating cosmetology school, I ended up checking myself into an inpatient program in Long Beach for a few months. And it was a great program, but I was just not ready for it at all. I was very much in this state or mindset that it wasn't about anything other than food and my body. And it's just, I'm just here to get control of my body. And they're like, no, this is not about food. And I'm like, of course it is. It's only about food. But I met one of my really good friends who also had a big love affair with cocaine. And by the time I got kicked out of treatment, because if you don't know how treatment works, with insurance, if you do well and if you improve too much, then they're going to kick you out. But if you don't improve and you don't do well enough, then they're going to kick you out. So like you're always like trying to be in this like I'm improving but not too much. So eventually everyone gets kicked out. And the very first day, like went down to San Diego, stayed with a friend and got a bunch of cocaine, and like my eating disorder and cocaine habit just was on full force pretty much from then on out until I was done eventually. I moved to New York in 2012 for makeup. I had finally started actually working as a makeup artist and hairstylist in LA, but I had really wanted to move to New York. And I went there for like a week in the winter time to see if I can handle the snow. And I had met a girl at a tattoo shop because I actually used to be a body piercer. That's how I funded my, I guess that's not how I funded my makeup school, but that was like my nighttime job. But I worked in a lot of tattoo shops for several years, and I knew this. I worked with this artist that was on New York Inc. And he, you know, when I was out in New York, I went to that shop to check it out, and I met some people, and I ended up living with the girl that I met for like the first month when I moved out there. And my first day being out there, she introduced me to like her best friend, and her best friend was a stripper. And I was like, oh, cool. I'm looking for a job. Because the way that I paid for me to move out to New York, I was working at Sephora during the day, and I was working at a strip club at night, but I wasn't dancing. I was just a soda waitress out in the valley at a full nude bar. And because I had had a good friend who was a waitress that ended up dancing, and once I got to New York and met her, I thought, well, I don't know anyone out here. I'm not going to run into anybody, that's for sure. Might as well dance. Because I didn't have a job. And also that friend had an affinity for cocaine too. So it was just, I figured out everything in that first day. So I started dancing, and I had moved there with the intent to get a job at this company called Makeup Forever. They're like a professional makeup brand, kind of similar to MAC, but more pro-focused. And I got a job with them in Soho. And that was like a dream job. But, you know, New York's a hustle and it's expensive. And so, and I had a very expensive drug habit that I needed to pay for. So I was stripping at night. And the club that I worked at was actually like a really, really cool bar. It was very well known. It still is very well known in Brooklyn. And it was just a topless bar. So I liked it because alcohol was there. And everybody there was also like, you know, from the wrong side of the tracks like me, like had a lot of tattoos. Whereas like the clubs in Manhattan, you can't work out if you have tattoos. So it was like the club for rejects. I was an awful stripper. I don't like talking to people, like obviously. I'm like really shy and stuff, and I totally used alcohol and cocaine to be social. But I would basically just like do my dance, and then afterwards you have to like go around the bar and like make your rounds and be like, "Ooh, give me money." And that was the only way I made money. Otherwise, like I never hustled for dances or anything because I didn't want to. And I would just sit downstairs and just do blow all night. But every now and then, of course, you know, you sit at the bar and you have some drinks and someone pulls you into the lap dance room. And I know a lot of other people have talked about, you know, working in a club is a slippery slope to doing other things. And I had this guy that was in the club, and I actually thought he was pretty attractive. And he was the first, I think the first person to approach me about making an arrangement with me outside of the club. And I agreed, and that's kind of how I had started my small little stint with escorting. It started off as mainly just that guy, but then he, you know, told his friends, and it changed. I didn't really... That was like just a really big secret for me too. Like no one really knew that I was doing that. And it was crazy too, because it was like an hour cab ride for me to get to wherever this was. So no one had any idea where I was going. But I eventually kind of stopped and backed off of that. And ultimately met Jimmy. Jimmy came into our club a lot. He was definitely a regular and he definitely had money. And the girls would always go to him whenever he would come in because of his money, definitely not because of his looks. And we were outside of the club one time. I was like smoking a cigarette or something. And he asked me if I had ever smoked cocaine. And I was like, what? You don't smoke it. You snort it. What are you talking about? And he's like, you should smoke it. Try it. You'll like it. And so I did. And I liked it. And that started a whole new chapter with me. I started hanging out with that guy way too much. I don't know what he did. He did something in the music industry. And all I know is we would go to like the studio that he had or worked at that was right on the waterline in Brooklyn. And he had gold records of Britney Spears' Circus album and some other artists that I knew at the time. I don't know what the fuck he did, but he did something with music and had a lot of money. And I think he would tell me things like, oh yeah, I can literally make anyone a star. I can, like, you don't have to have talent. Like, anything you want, I can make your dreams come true. And so I think we like had some like silly plans or something of doing things, but of course, like, that was all bullshit and it was just all about drugs mostly initially. We would go through so much of it that, you know, you start cutting it after a while. And then I just remember at one point being in the studio and having the little like glass pipe and being like, this is crack, isn't it? And he was like, yeah, this is crack. I was like, I fucking thought so. Like, yeah. And crack is intense. I would go on these intense benders with him for like days and not go to work. And we stopped going to the studio. We started going to like his place, which he had this huge place. It was insane. This giant like loft studio thing. There was like basketball net in it and everything. Like, it was huge. And did a ton of crack and, you know, didn't take too long for what I know now was my debt was accumulating with this guy, and eventually got to the point to where he wanted to get paid back for it. And like, again, was so not attracted to this guy. I thought he was so gross and I really didn't want to, but you know, they're really good at manipulating you and putting you in this position of like, yeah, but I've done all these things for you. I've been so kind to you. But so nice. We're friends, you know, and also he was married, but I never saw this wife. And I know that he acquired his wife in Southeast Asia somewhere. And I don't really remember the details of the scenario. I just know at one point he had me at a sleazy paid by the hour motel, and he's wanting me to do things for him. And I just knew I had to get out. And, you know, like, my makeup career wasn't going anywhere really at that point. And I think now looking back that he was trying to groom me into doing like, you know, more trafficking things. It's very obvious now that I've like learned about it, but and heard other stories. But thankfully I just disappeared from the club for a long time and from him and got out. And things got a lot better. Makeup career was taking off, started building a good clientele, and I fell in love. Really short relationship though. with this girl. I like totally fell in love with her on a job, and she broke my heart. She dumped me for good reason. I was an awful girlfriend. Go figure. I had still have so many issues and security issues and self-worth issues, and she couldn't handle it. And so I was super heartbroken. I'm about to get kicked out of my apartment because I had two cats, and I told my landlord that I didn't have any cats, and he found out. So I was trying to find a place to go, and I was really lonely, and I met this girl named Margie. And Margie was this Puerto Rican chick from like the wrong side of the tracks. And we never even ever had a date. Like, we hung out the first night and did tons of drugs. And, you know, I like crashed on the floor, I think. And she quickly, 2 weeks later, she had me moving into her apartment with her because she had her own one bedroom apartment. And, it's so true, the analogy and what they say and talk about, the frog in a pot of boiling water. Like, that's exactly like what this relationship was. Really slowly over time, she started to control things, and she started to, violate my privacy, and started to yell, and then started to throw things, and then started to break things, and then started to get physically violent. And I hadn't really been in many relationships, honestly. I'd only been in like a couple real relationships at that point, and never for a long period of time. And even though I was dancing when she met me, she made me quit dancing because she didn't want me being in the club. My best favorite client that I ever had in New York was this company, this aerialist company, super well known, called Body and Pull. And they did like hoops and pull and silks. And they have like 15 or 20 instructors, and pretty much every single one of them was my client. And I was like living in that studio. And that was when I learned that I could do pole dancing in a more artistic way. And it didn't always have to be in such like a sexy way, which it can be, and that's great, and that has its place too, but you can use pole to do other things, and to express like darker emotions. And I really fell in love with doing pole at that point. I like had stopped working at the club at night and started working during the day, and I just basically used it as like my practice for like getting better at pole. And I kind of like felt connected with the cheer side of me, who was, being flexible and athletic and strong and doing these cool acrobatic things. And she did not like me doing that. This was like right when Instagram was fresh and new. So I had, videos of like me in class, whether it was like a choreography class or something. And, she made me take it all down. Had me stop going to the studio. I booked a makeup job on my birthday, and she lost her shit and made me cancel it. I mean, she was just extremely controlling, extremely violent. I came home one day, and she was so jealous about the girl that I was in love with that, had broken my heart. And like at one point, she made me delete all of my photos of her and I on my computer. So I don't have any of that anymore. And then one day I came home, and she had taken my journal and photocopied particular old passages from before I even met her. and they were plastered all over the apartment, like all over the walls, all over down the hallway, all over the bathroom, the bedroom, like everywhere. And still to this day, I can't really write in the journal. It like totally fucked me up. Like one time, it was some holiday and I had cleaned or cooked a big whole meal for her. And I had said something about, yeah, well, you're doing the dishes. And she said she was not. And I'm very stubborn and I like to argue. And so I, you know, kept saying, yes, you are. Like, are you kidding? That would be so mean. And ultimately, like, she like smashed everything, broke it, and ended up on top of me, just like choking me out. And that was like a time where I thought, like I gave up at a certain point. And, you know, you just, the light starts to go and you're like, fuck, this is not how I thought this was going to go down. But I woke up. But it just started getting worse. And, you know, we would have nights where the cops were being called on us all the time. And every time they would, like I just have like memories and flashes of just like her having her hand over my mouth and it's like bloody. And she's like telling me, shut the fuck up and don't you say anything. Like, I was never allowed to open the door for the cops. And, oddly enough, even the violence wasn't enough to really break me into leaving. It was the sleep deprivation. So like the last couple months of me living there, she really didn't want me to sleep. So she would just do, you know, a bunch of blow all night. And if I tried to fall asleep, like she was so dramatic. She would literally like grab the mattress, like break the bed. The bed was broken at some point. Like just throw shit all around, like make a nuisance, like did everything she could to just, I don't know why, just fucking torture me. And I'd had enough of it finally. And one day she went to work and I had a friend waiting outside with a U-Haul. And as soon as she left, we packed up that U-Haul and I moved to Jersey. Just started really, you know, I became very like masculine. I like shaved my head and started dressing very masculine and didn't realize that it was because of what had happened. And it took me years to even realize that she was abusive, even though she had called me and told me she was sorry for being abusive. But eventually I got my life back. Eventually I moved back to Brooklyn and I was looking for something more in life and was thinking of traveling to Thailand for a little bit. And I don't know, the universe or God presented this amazing opportunity where a former colleague of mine was working for an NGO. Her cousin started this NGO, which is actually a freedom business. And freedom businesses are to help those who usually young, I wouldn't say even just young adults, like younger than that too, but young people who have either been trafficked or are at risk for trafficking. It gives them a trade so they can have a new career and a new life. And the one that they had started was a beauty academy. And they got hired to do a TV show in Cambodia. And I got hired to do initially the makeup, but ultimately I ended up leading both the hair and makeup team for the show. And all of the students were my assistants for the show. And it's not just that they were learning hair and makeup, you know, they were also learning everything else about life and morals and values. And we would have these gratitude huddles every day where we'd go around and say what we were grateful for. And that whole experience just completely like changed me and broke me. Cambodia is intense. I mean, I like hid for a few days when I first got there. It was overwhelming, but you just see, like, the trafficking is just so blunt. It's just so in your face. It's everywhere you go, and there's just little children everywhere too, doing their own hustle. And you think, oh, if I, you know, buy this bracelet, it's going to help them. But they're being trafficked by somebody. They're not getting the money. You know, everything is just all a scam and an exploitation. And after, it was supposed to be a 3-month job, it ended up being a 6-month job. And after we were done, I had just really fallen in love with the country and my expat community and my students, of course. And I stayed. And we had a client at the salon who was an ambassador for the Wildlife Alliance. And I just took her out for coffee and said, hey, I don't know what you do, but I love it. I love wildlife and I love animals. And I would just love to help and be a part of whatever it is you have going on. And she was in the middle of starting her own NGO, Animal Mama, which has now turned into this. I mean, they have a few locations now, but it's mostly a veterinary hospital that's round-the-clock care. But when we started off, she basically was her own rescue. And we did cats and dogs. There's really, really bad stray cat and dog problems. But we also rescued dogs from the dog meat trade and rehabilitated them, which is really rough because they believe that if the animals are scared before they die, then the meat tastes better. So that was like really hard but rewarding, helping those dogs out. You know, during the Vietnam War, we dropped tons of mines and bombs all over Cambodia, and there's tons of mines to this day that still haven't been found and removed and undetonated. And they use demining dogs to go out and sniff them and find them. And after these dogs were done, they would normally just get euthanized. And so we started like a home for them so people could adopt them and they could just be dogs after, you know, being of service to us. It was just an amazing experience. Wildlife trafficking is really big there. Pangolins are the number one trafficked mammal in the world. And we had worked with a lot of pangolin trafficking and, you know, like elephants and tigers, just monkeys, of course, just everything. And I just felt like I wanted to do more. And I had been having this idea of wanting to go back to school. And when I was in Jersey, I went down this rabbit hole with the cosmos and became obsessed with like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Earth and like earth science. And just, I don't know. I would just get drunk a lot and just keep talking about how like space and the earth was cool. And I basically did acid one night just by myself. I went home and a friend had given it to me for my birthday and I'd never done it before. And I thought, I'm going to do acid tonight. This sounds like a fun idea. And at the time I was like very overweight, or at least I wasn't, but in my head I was overweight and just uncomfortable. And, you know, I was dressing like a boy. I kind of hated my body. And I just remember looking down and honestly, like seeing the body that I more so have now and just like feeling this immense feeling of love and care for myself. And I never felt that before. And I had this message that came to me that said, you need to stop doing drugs. And I think you should go back to school. And so I talked to my boss about it and I told her what I was thinking. And she said, if you want to do that, I'll put you on a plane tomorrow. So very quickly I left, eventually made my way back to California. Got sober for a year and a half. And, you know, that was just the beginning of the real journey, because once you stop, now you're just left with yourself and all of the problems and all of the choices that you've made. And God, it's been a hell of a journey, but I did it. I enrolled at Santa Monica College, 2018. I took 4 years to get my associate's degree because I had to relearn everything. I didn't know I didn't remember any algebra, let alone chemistry or biology. But I got my associate's degree in general science and transferred to UCLA. And I now have a bachelor's in environmental science and a minor in conservation biology. And through that journey, rediscovered my love for the ocean because I grew up like surfing and always swimming a lot and just loved being in the water, and fell in love with seaweed. And now I'm wrapping up my thesis research in my master's program at UCLA in molecular cell and developmental biology.
Good for you.
Which is crazy. Yeah, if I was told back then that this is where I would have ended up, I would have asked for those drugs immediately. But yeah, I don't do anything like that anymore, and I have it, and it's, I don't know. I think for me, what's important is that, like, I'm trying to break my generational trauma cycle. I'm trying to face the things that happened to me and not be afraid to process things that are hard and scary. And it takes a lot of work. Like, this has not been easy by any means. Getting sober was almost like the easier part, but it's the learning how to live with yourself is the hardest part. And knowing that the journey to process everything and to change your life and to turn your life around, like, it's not linear at all. It's messy, and you make steps forward and you make a lot of steps back, and you just have to be diligent. You just have to have this, like, relentless passion driving you towards healing. And for me, I don't think I really learned to love myself until I got my autism diagnosis, because I had just always thought that I was different and didn't belong, and I didn't understand myself, and I didn't understand why I would always upset people and had such a hard time with things. And I think loving yourself is so key. I mean, I know you've talked about it. Like, love is the answer for everything. It's love and it's good parents. And we can't be afraid to talk about things that are uncomfortable. And I don't like where I feel like we started a little bit in society going towards this direction of not wanting to talk about things. And that's what's so important for this show and for this this platform, to be able to share these stories and to be able to talk about the things that we don't want to talk about, that we don't want to face, that are too uncomfortable.
How do you think autism makes you a little different than maybe the average person?
Yeah. I mean, it affects your nervous system a lot. And so just physically being in my body and in my head is really different, but, I've done a lot of research because a lot of women don't get diagnosed with autism. It goes misdiagnosed. And if they get diagnosed, it won't happen until their adulthood. And there's a huge overlap between women being diagnosed with autism with having previous diagnoses of BPD, of course, PTSD, depression, general anxiety, OCD. So there's a lot of overlap. And autistic girls in particular are much higher at risk than anyone else for sexual abuse and exploitation and manipulation. And yeah, like, if I would have known how I was different, and if I would have been given the tools to know what to look for in people, then I don't know, things could have been different, I guess. But I wanted to share that part because the more I learn about it, the more I fear that there are a lot of other girls and women like me that are being taken advantage of and don't understand why.
And what's the next step for you now?
I graduate in a few months, and then I'm moving to Hawaii.
Good for you.
I've gone into free diving a lot. I'm a scientific diver as well, but free diving has really helped a lot. In a scientific way, too, it kicks in your mammalian dive reflex, which lowers your heart rate, and it's very calming and soothing. And I'm excited to go back to a tropical place and just spend my life. I teach to pay for school, and I teach a life science class for non-STEM majors, and I've also found a passion with that. I've always loved teaching, but I like connecting with students that have never been told that they could be science people, or have been told that they can't be science people. And I really hope to bring that to Hawaii as well. I would love to teach and help with science communication.
How much of what you went through in your younger years was just part of just growing up?
A lot, for sure.
Because as we mature, we mellow out and we become a little more responsible and more stable, more like you are now.
Kind of. I don't know how stable I am. I definitely have a lot of bad days. Again, it's not easy. Things are never easy.
That's life.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
All right. Well, Kate, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah.
I wish you lots of luck in Hawaii.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.